You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as Fork in the Road, Small Things Often, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
I've been researching the Kentucky Goblins case vigorously since 2017, and we've talked about it here on the show before, but I finally put all of my research into one two-part article, which is being published in the UK's Skeptic magazine, and I will link to that in the show notes. There's still a wad of remaining misconceptions and myths about this case that I wanted to give any thoughtful Wikipedia editors an easy-to-use resource that they could use to steer the article towards a more accurate view of what took place one hot, dark August night in rural Kentucky. I hope you'll forgive me for once again getting a bit ranty in this episode, but I feel very strongly about both this story and how the people in the skeptic community comport themselves when working on what many people uses their first stop on their investigations into famous mysteries. We can do better, people, and I hope that my research is able to facilitate that effort.
Monster Talk.
I tell you what, I'm excited because a lot of these projects that we've been working on that we're highlighting in these sort of what are we doing episodes, It's stuff I've been working on for a long time, and I'm excited to see it actually sort of getting finalized.
You have, yeah. And I think your investigations are a little different to mine, but I like the way you do them. The fact that you're working on something over a long period of time. I tend to kind of do a deep dive and work on something for a shorter period, but you really do keep coming back to these cases and you keep finding out more and more. I guess it's a kind of softly catchy monkey approach that you have, and I'm excited to talk about this topic, and we have talked about this before, the Kentucky Goblins, but you have a slightly different perspective that you want to tackle today.
Okay, first of all, we've talked about this topic multiple times, so I don't want to do a giant deep dive into the story of what happened in Kentucky in 1955.
Right, we've done
but
that.
I've got links in the show notes. I'll link back to the previous episode coverage if you want to listen to something, And I'll link to this article. It's a two-part article that's part two should be live on Monday after this episode drops. So I'll link to that as well. But because I know if you're coming in cold, you don't know the story at all, you do need some kind of summary. I have composed a poem. You ready?
I'm ready. I'm ready. You're just like William Blake, your namesake.
Yes, exactly. Here we go. In August of 1955, some farmers tried to stay alive as little goblins hopped around and scared the farmers into town. The sheriff and the police, too, searched the farm for any clue. The farmers were truly scared, but without a goblin, no one cared. And afterwards, the camps were split. Was this a hoax or was it legit? And somehow, doubters proudly thunk, it wasn't goblins, they was drunk. Though how much drink would it take to make the sober hallucinate?
Yay! I love it. That really encapsulates everything. That, well done.
It kind of does.
Very well done. So, okay, I guess that's the story out of the way. What angle did you want to take today?
Well, the first part of the article, like part one that's already out, is a very, I think, thorough overview of the case. Part two is about lingering mysteries and some really pernicious misconceptions that are embedded in the Wikipedia coverage of this topic.
Right.
And I've been trying to get that fixed. And I think part two is like bullet by bullet, pardon the not intentional pun, the rare unintended pun. I go through some of the remaining stuff that's in there and just sort of demolish the myths that are baked into Wikipedia. And it really bugs me, but we'll get into that.
Yeah. So what are some of the key myths that are remaining in this case?
Again, enshrined in the Wikipedia article is the idea that the phrase little green men sort of got kicked off with the Kentucky Goblins case.
Okay.
And that is repeated ad nauseum across the internet. And so
happens. Yeah.
How could you sort of, I kind of take a Popperian, Karl Popper approach to this stuff. Can it be falsified? Can we show that it's not the case? And
right.
Yes, it's extraordinarily easy to do some text string searches on a good search engine, especially like Google Books or newspapers.com, and look for the phrase little green men prior to 1955. And you'll discover that by the 1930s, the phrase was already embedded in science fiction. But it actually goes back much further. Little green men used to mean fairies and goblins and that sort of thing. So it is kind of appropriate in a way that it got associated with this case. But this case is in no way pioneering its use as either sci-fi or as code for drunken hallucinations.
Right. Yeah. So why do you think that is attached to the story, maybe to kind of legitimize it further?
I think it's because this case has sort of a class element in it. The people who were the witnesses were poor farmers, and they have been mocked mercilessly far beyond their lifespans clearly, if you read, go back and look at the original source material, was a traumatic night's events. But it's so much easier to dismiss them as rubes, as drunks, as anything except a sober witness. there's nothing to back that up, but we'll get to that.
What are some other myths that we need to look at?
Sure. Probably the most dramatic is when, this case was researched by Isabel Davis and Ted Bletcher, who were two UFO researchers for QFOS, the Center for UFO Studies, which, pet peeve, their work was incredibly journalistic. They went and did interviews. It is not a book full of accusations that it was aliens. Mm-hmm. What it really is a really great step-by-step recap of what happened.
Okay.
And it gives it context. The folklore, but also, you know, they give it context of this wasn't an isolated event. In 1955, in that era, there were people spotting humanoid aliens and, you know, all over the place. And that doesn't mean that there really were UFOs and aliens all over the place or flying saucers. It means people were reporting them. It was in the zeitgeist. So whether there was anything to any of those cases is kind of not the point. The point is that it was a cultural moment when UFOs, aliens, little green men were already out there as a culturally available template for whatever you experience.
And do you think a lot of these were kind of copycat cases, or do you think they were independent?
I think that it was something new that was happening sort of after, you know, the events of Roswell and and the more importantly than Roswell, I think the first flying saucer, Kenneth Arnold's flying saucers really sort of set the world afire with this idea. And it's still going. That fire is still burning. You don't need fuel for it, apparently, other than people's curiosity and an unwillingness to actually understand what's floating around. But when people know, if a hot topic is, you know, UFOs and aliens, and you see something weird in the sky, then you have a weird creature, you know, outside your house, aliens is a perfectly rational explanation if you're not super informed.
I mean, if you think that way, yeah.
Yeah. But people were so disappointed after the events when there were no aliens found, there was no crashed ship. They started naysaying literally every aspect of the story, including the part where the poor farmers had been scared, hiding inside their house and shooting out through the screen window at what they saw as little goblins. And there was photographs of the screen and there's drawings of the screen. People were speculating that they had just poked holes in the screen with a a tobacco stick, something from the garden.
A stick all kinds of, like,
yeah, but I don't know why. Like, no one just shot through a screen to see if it made that kind of hole. And I was researching this a few years ago, and I was like, wait a minute. It's a 22 and a 20-gauge shotgun. I own those weapons. I could just go get a vintage screen and shoot through it. And so
science, full science.
Exactly. And so I did. And I have to say, I was really surprised. Like, for one thing was, like, the hole in the screen was kind of squarish in the drawing. And it's like, well, why would a shotgun make a square hole? Probably due to the nature of the way the screen's put together. But when I did my shots, it did the same thing. It made a squarish hole. So, you know.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So do you think that they did shoot out of their screens?
100% I think they did. Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually surprised anybody doubted it. But, you know, they're willing to believe these are drunken rednecks, you know, making up a story. But not that they would fire a gun through a window. Come on. You know, it's a weird thing to be doubtful of. But I feel like I've demonstrated that the outcome they got was extremely plausible because I got the same outcome. So
yeah, it sounds dangerous, too. It could have been kids or something if they were 3 feet tall.
There's so much weird about this story. Like, so the one that's really got me mad.
WTF story.
Yes. And it is a weird story. And again, I think my conclusion is, and spoilers, but I think my conclusion is that what they experienced that night was probably them confronting a pair of territorial owls. But you got to understand that the cultural context was not a farm at night. It was a world where aliens are invading. It's a world where they're seeing something weird. They've only got two. They're in a dark farmhouse with like two little bulbs hanging on either of the entrances to the house. And if you've ever been in a dark, starlit night and had a light on, it only illuminates so far, and it actually makes everything else harder to see, you know?
Right, yeah.
And so I think that people just sort of imagine it being like a broad daylight kind of, you know, very clearly there were goblins from outer space kind of situation. It's like there's so many artist renditions that make it, you know, of course that's an alien, but the reality is they saw something in the shadows. They saw something in the dark. They were being touched in the dark. You know, a lot of weird things were happening.
Definitely need to place it within that context of the time and even the socioeconomic group, what the house would have been like. So I guess moving on, this whole drinking issue, a lot is made about that facet of the story. Were the witnesses drinking, in your opinion?
No, absolutely not. We have witnesses on site. We have one guy who says he thinks the goblins came out of a bottle. Everybody else is saying they didn't see any evidence of drinking. There was a couple of beer cans found on the farm at all.
Okay.
Now, you ever have a drink?
Once or twice.
I've occasionally had one. Have you,
really?
You ever been at a bar? You know how when you get to a bar and then like people get drunk and then everybody starts hallucinating? Oh, wait. That's not a thing that happens. What the?
That's true. I mean, I have been on some ghost hunting investigations where people kind of, I think their imaginations take them away a little bit.
Yes.
Spirits on
but
spirits,
have they ever been so drunk that the hallucinations spread across the room? Like,
not when it comes to alcohol. Let's say that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are plenty of hallucinogens and things that people can take that have not been mentioned with this case.
Yeah.
And so here, okay, this is an unfortunate story. Here's what's happened. There are people within the skeptical community who work on trying to make Wikipedia a less nonsense place.
Mm-hmm.
And to an extent, I totally agree with that attitude.
Sure.
You know.
On the surface, yeah.
But the way they implement that is often combative and irrational.
Right.
And when they find a thing that supports their view, they put that up even if it makes no sense. And that's what's happened here.
Yes.
And I feel really bad about this because this what they've done is they've linked to a paper. And that paper has elements in it that are just wrong. I don't know how else to put it. It was written by Rodney Schmaltz and Scott Lilienfeld. And Scott has done yeoman's work in skeptical work in the field. I mean, he really has done a great work trying to make the world a more rational place. I don't know Rodney, but what they did was they wrote a paper, and it was about how to use skepticism and sort of pseudoscience in the classroom.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they picked this case as a good example of how you could use this in the classroom.
Okay, so they were speculating.
Right, they were. And this paper is not a case study about the Kentucky Goblins. It's about using skepticism and pseudoscience in the classroom. That's what the paper's about.
And it was an example.
It is an example. It's just an example. And they cited two sources. They cited Joe Nichols' research, and they cited the Bletcher and Davis papers from QFOS. Okay.
Okay.
And then they said that those sources showed that alcohol was the root cause. That is just not true.
Mm.
Both of those sources do not say. In fact, both sources explicitly deny that alcohol was likely the cause or even a factor that night.
Wow.
So it's a really bad citation to the point that I wrote both of them, and they had to issue a change to the article. But you don't see that. If you go look at the article, it looks the same. But if you go back to the source that's, you know, hosting the article, it'll show the correction. But the correction's wrong, too. It still says alcohol may have been a cause. Alcohol was not a factor in this case. It should never have been part of the evidence used to support that hypothesis.
Well, that just makes skeptics look bad, and it's kind of doing exactly what we accuse the other side of doing.
Yeah, this article is like just a beautiful example of how not to make the world a more rational place. They basically replaced the story they didn't want with another wrong story that they did. And their wrong story is, on the face of it, absurd. You could just check. It's a you know, this is not where little green men come from. It had nothing to do with drinking. You know, there are real reasons why people see weird stuff. People need to wake up and stop making up dumb reasons.
Absolutely. And hopefully our listeners, that there might be someone out there who might be able to help to fix those errors on Wikipedia.
It would be ideal. In fact, I'll be blunt. The way I wrote this article, I'm hoping that it can be cited instead of the Schmaltz and Lilienfeld article.
Good thinking.
You know,
perfect.
So like it just literally gives all the sources that you need to fix it. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I just it's so frustrating. And I want to say that I've had some really great interactions with the people over at Astonishing Legends, because they sort of got me fired up about this. They were the ones who showed me. Yeah, they've covered this topic as much as we have, and I think they're in the same boat. They'd like to see the article fixed, because that is, I think, for most people, where they learn about stuff or go to see what's the real story. I'll go to Wikipedia, and sometimes that's no good, you know.
Right. I mean, even just as a starter point, but it's not good that these myths are being perpetuated and these false explanations as well. But moving on, the flipping goblins. What was up with the flipping goblins?
What was up with the flipping goblins? That's what I want to know.
Not a curse word.
the description of the goblins from that night included some very strange things, like they floated, which if they're owls, not surprising.
That, they kind of, obvious.
They kind of glowed.
Their eyes
and they had
glowed.
Long arms, and they walked with short little stiff legs. Again, sounds like owls, but there's this one element.
Non-human primates.
Yeah.
Long arms.
Long arms, that's right. Well, people do draw them like little monkeys. That's a real thing. I mean, there's all kinds of artistic interpretations.
Yeah, I've seen lots of trippy ones.
I was on a call with Joe Nickel, and we were talking about this, and he mentioned that the fact that they flipped was still kind of a mystery to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him what I'll tell you and what I wrote in the article. I grew up in a family that hunted. I have largely dropped out of that, but I used to be a regular bird hunter.
Okay.
And every
Didn't
September we would go. Yeah, we hunted doves. That's like, it was our big family get together. And I had wonderful times. And it's hard to shoot them. They move fast and flip. They flip.
Good for
That's
them.
One of the things that they do.
Good for them.
If you shoot at them, sometimes they will flip in the air, like over and over, tumbling, and then recover and continue flying. And I couldn't tell in those cases, was that a dodge? Or had I hit them and that was them falling and then recovering? I don't know. But what I later found out was, you know, doves are in the sort of pigeon family.
Mm-hmm.
And there are entire breeds of pigeons that are called tumblers. And they will tumble through the air and flip end over end that way.
Okay.
And so I told this to Joe, and he was like, so there are birds that can tumble in the air as sort of a defensive mechanism and then recover. You know, and whether the tumblers do that in the pigeon world as a defense or it's just a behavior that they have, I don't know. But I do know that I've seen it in gunplay on hunting fields with doves. So I can only say that doves and pigeons, which are closely related, do flip. But it is possible that it's true for owls, too. And that would explain it. But the thing is, I would never shoot an owl. You know, and so I don't
Luckily,
know how
you don't
to
shoot doves or pigeons anymore, too.
Well, I don't. I don't think it's a moral outrage or anything, but I don't do it. I just, you know, I've got plenty of other ways to get food. And while it is, it is absolutely fun, I can do the same thing with clay targets and have a good time shooting that way.
Much better. But I guess that's for another discussion.
Yeah, it is. And also, I just don't have time to go shooting anymore. It's like I'm too busy and I like it, but I prefer fishing. So
it is Ryan here. And I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Well, I'll reach who it will.
That is an interesting perspective and definitely something to take into consideration too. But let's move on and talk a bit about the investigation. How organized was it? And how many government agencies participated? Because I've heard different versions.
Yeah, it is really interesting to me because, again, because you had a sheriff's department and from two counties, and the police department and Air Force and possibly government agents from other agencies there, it becomes what happens is when they do these TV recreations, it's not sort of a random assortment of people piling up on this, you know, farm to find out what's going on. It's like, we're from the government. We're here to help. You know, it's a super organized and elite, you know, and it's like, I've been working, you know, I was in the Navy. I know what it was really. This was
reality.
It was a crime scene, sort of, you know, not a crime, but it was that it was like a police response in a small town adjacent to a large town. Right. Mm-hmm. So Kelly is just like a little cluster of farms. But Hopkinsville was a big town. And so when the radio alert went out from the police department, the sheriff's department, I don't think it's that surprising that other agencies who had people with time on their hands showed up.
Right.
But it seems like it was much more of a an organically impromptu kind of response, not a, well,
that
the government's got to hop on this, you know, seize the craft, you know, hide the evidence. You know, it's nothing like that. Although you would not get that picture from most of the dramatic and, I'm air quoting, documentary displays on this particular story.
Right. Okay. Got it.
That, it was a night of chaos. Sense. Yeah.
It sounds like it was. It really does. When you hear people who were actually involved in the event, it sounds like they were scared and things were chaotic for sure.
Now, I want to add one more thing. There was one more element that sometimes is usually missed. I've seen it on a couple of UFO websites. They bring up the connection. Mm-hmm. And Jeb pointed it out to me, Jeb Card. But what it is that two of our carnival people, like, so some of the people who were at the farmhouse that night had worked in the carnival. And they had actually just come back from Evansville, which is one state up in Indiana.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And while they were in Evansville, 1 week before this event, a woman, and it got on the front page, a woman felt like she had been attacked by like a weird underwater hand that had grabbed her in the river. And there was all kinds of, you know, spooky. What kind of monster was it? So it was a monster story about a monster attacking a woman in the river a week before these guys showed up in Kelly and then had this experience. And I'm not saying it's a copycat thing. Far from it. I'm thinking that further supports the hypothesis that they were in a monster frame of mind, like that they were already thinking about
Absolutely.
The world's full of weird monsters. Mm-hmm. You don't never know what's going to happen to you. You know, that kind of thing.
And that affected their interpretation of the events.
I think so. I really do. And
that makes
sense. I linked all that in there. So, I mean, when you come down to it, this whole story I think it should be a really important story for skeptics and believers because it shows you how people can have the sort of Rashomon style, well, I think it was this and I think it was that.
Yeah,
even
the camps.
Like the people who saw it, you know, they gave testimony to a sketch artist and that most of their stuff looked kind of the same. One guy who was prone to hyperbole, let's say that, his was the only one that was different, which completely matches the sort of characters that are described in the Davis and Bletcher paper, where most of them are they're sober Christian farm people, simple folk who have this weird experience. And then one guy is, you know, it was a spaceship. You know, he's a little more creative in his responses, but that doesn't mean nothing happened. It doesn't mean nothing happened.
Yeah,
the fact
that
everybody was scared, something happened. You know?
Yeah, there was definitely something that took place that night. And but it's just such so confusing to read about the different stories and the different versions. I mean, everyone has their opinion on it, but certainly there's a lot of folklore out there, and it's difficult to tease that apart. So, Blake, what would you like to see happen with the Wikipedia entry on this case?
Well, I'd like to get it, this is not really a word, I guess, demythified. I'd like to get...
it sounds like a good word to me.
I could tell you a parallel case that I think I've probably talked about this before, but it really was informative to me, was the Leopold and Loeb case, the murder case. There's a newspaper story that famously was supposed to have had the headline, today Richard Loeb, despite his erudition, ended his sentence with a proposition, which is an incredibly rude homosexual joke at the expense of a murderer. So I'm not losing sleep over it. But it was so funny that it was commonly told in journalism classes as this like famous headline or in the obituary for the writer who wrote it or said to have written it. The New York Times said that that was a real headline. And that was the basis for that being included in the Leopold and Loeb Wikipedia page as a real thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's so cool. I'd love to have that headline on a little poster in my wall. So I went to go print it out and couldn't find the newspaper article, had to order microfiche, got them all delivered, started reading it. And of course, that's not what any of the headlines said, because good God, it was 1930s. Nobody's going to put a gay murder joke as a headline. That's ridiculous. So, you know, realizing how absurd it was, I tried to get it removed from Wikipedia as not existing. But because people say that it does and they say it in print, those primary sources or those secondary sources trump the fact that it's bloody not true. And so it's crazy. So it's hard to get bad information out of Wikipedia. So I'm hoping that maybe they can rewrite it and say, you know, for example, the Little Green Man is said to have come from this, but researcher Blake Smith, I don't even want my name. I don't care. It's not about me, but it's like research has shown that pre-existed as an idiom. You know, let's just fix the things that are broken. You know, the people were not drinking. Stop referencing that Schmaltz and Lilienfeld article. That's not what that article is for. It's a misappropriation of the article. The article itself is wrong. It's misusing the work by Nickel and Davis and Bletcher. I think Davis is dead, but Bletcher's still alive, even though he's very, very old. I mean, it's just wrong, and it needs to be fixed.
It needs to be cleaned up. Absolutely. Yeah. And I see what you're saying, that you could absolutely preface these things with, this is what's commonly believed, but... Yeah. Here's the reality. I think it could be done, and it needs to be done. So hopefully someone will help out.
Part of it is that they don't want to use sources that they deem, you know, not science-y enough. For example, Lyle Blackburn's work. You know, I don't know what Lyle believes, and I think if you read his work, you won't know either, because he does a journalistic approach and just talks about what people are saying.
Exactly.
They strip out Lyle's books as sources, saying, well, that's a believer book. And I'm like, you can't. No, no. Mm. That is the worst kind of editorial nonsense. I mean, if the work is valid and it's based on sources, and Lyle absolutely gives all his sources.
He does.
Then you can't just like strip other people's evidence out because you don't like the book. I mean, if it's nonsense, that's different. Okay. Anyway, Wikipedia is a chore. It's not a goal that can be achieved forever. It's always going to take work.
Yes.
And
I'm
glad people want to fix it. But it's an ongoing project. You got to have patience and you've got to follow the rules. And I think some of the people in skepticism working on this do a good job of teaching people the rules, but maybe have a spirit of sort of journalistic integrity and don't try to get your agenda above everyone else's. I mean, your agenda may be right, but follow the rules, you know, be a sensible, reasonable person. So.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a big, important message there. And this does need to be tackled. Did you want, was there anything else?
No, I feel like this got the heart of it, but I would encourage people to read both parts of the article. And if you want to be a Wikipedia editor, you know, see if you can figure out how to incorporate reality with that article.
Yep. We need the assistance here. But so we recently talked about the Patterson-Gimlin film, and today revisited the Kentucky Goblins. What else are you working on at the moment, Blake?
Well, I'm trying to get Joe Nichols' book out. I'm getting really close. I've got a little bit of front
Great
matter
news.
To work out. Yeah. And I've started working on the audiobook version. And,
oh, are you doing the reading?
I am.
Oh,
it'll be me.
Cool.
So unfortunately, it'll also be me editing it. So yeah, hang tight. But
no, it sounds good.
And I've been working on a project tied to King Kong, but I've got to I don't want to say more about that, because I think someone could easily scoop me if I say too much.
Yeah, you've got to be careful with that.
Yeah,
we know that from experience.
Yep. Well, but this is really fun. I'm excited. We've got some fun cryptid episodes coming up in the hopper.
Me too. And thank you again for all of your hard work and your research, and it's good to have you out there on our side doing this kind of work. It's really important and valuable work.
I will say that I did get a couple of really interesting emails from listeners about the Patterson-Gimlin stuff. And the people who wrote me are hardcore Bigfooters. And I really appreciate the fact that they bothered to listen and they liked my research. I love it. I'm really happy about that.
That's great to hear that we're reaching different people.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not just preaching to the choir.
Yeah. I mean, because if anything, people ought to figure at this point that I may be a skeptic, but we love monsters.
You're a reasonable person. And I really think that the people who aren't reasonable are in the minority. They're the few. Sometimes they're the loudest. That's the problem.
Yes. Yes. Often so. Yeah. It's the silent middle. Yeah. So. You want to talk about what you're working on? I mean, since we've got a minute.
My latest book is going to be coming out probably mid-year. And so I don't know if it's tangential. It's not.
What's the title?
So, Bitch.
Beep.
The
Sorry,
journey.
What? Could you say it again?
Bitch, Beep. The journey of a word. Not
nice.
The worst thing that we've said on the show.
No, not at all. So.
But yeah, it's a deep dive into the word. And I mean, it's a long story as to why I've written this book, and it's been several years in the making. Not paranormal, obviously, but there are lots of skeptical angles to it because there are weird theories about the etymology of the word, where it came from, and how it's behaved, what it's done. So, you know, there's always skepticism in everything I've found, any research I've done. Whether it's linguistics or the paranormal, there's a skeptical
angle. Especially when you're doing historical stuff, it's so hard to know for sure, you know.
A lot of theories floating out there, and you really have to delve into that and see what really happened here. But it's such an interesting story, and yeah, I'm pretty proud of the work. I always think my latest book is my best, but that's what I'm thinking again.
That's a good thing to think. I like that. Well, even if it's not directly topical for what we cover here, it's good for people to know what you're working on. So that's awesome. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to a discussion of the case of the Kelly Hopkinsville goblins, and I'll be putting this case on the shelf for a while. I do have one remaining weird claim from this story that I'd like to address, but just an initial look into it made me realize it was its own whole class of misguided explanation for monsters. So we'll be getting back to that another day because it crosses lots of cases. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. We're a weird little show for people just like you, and we're delighted that you found us.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.